welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, you're talking about this book that explains a lot of different things that you're reading, especially the baby boomers.
Well, yeah, this book, The Aftermath, Philip Bump, a Washington Post reporter, but it's not an ideologically driven book at all. It's all statistics, basically, right. And analysis, cultural analysis, and it is really eye-opening being a baby boomer, because we've always congratulated ourselves on our generation, and that's one of the attributes we always have, but I didn't realize how huge we were and what an impact we had. And particularly on like this post-war prosperity that I've described, the golden era, in 1946, that was the beginning of the baby boom period, which incidentally, in the summer of 46, three of our presidents were born within 66 days of one another.
You know, there was a movie named The Summer of 46, yeah, right.
Well, three of our presidents, Clinton, Bush II, and Trump, were born within 66 days of one another. That was the beginning of the baby boom, the very first summer. At that point in 1946, the population of America was, I think, 142 million. In 75 million kids were born from 1946 to 1964. That's the baby boom generation. And at the end of the baby boom generation birth time in 1964, the country was 225 million, of which 75 million of that 225 were baby boomers, okay? We were the growth of that period, but we were also by far the biggest generation. And we have been that biggest generation all the way through. We have been, we were predominantly white. We were predominantly Protestant. We were predominantly religious. You look at the profile of us, and it's a very interesting profile, some of which has changed over the years in terms of our religiosity or which religions we were. But we have been in control of America since we reached teenage years. Madison Avenue shifted its gears and began to advertise to teenage America when we became teenagers, because we were such a big source of sales. 17 magazine came out when we were 17 years old, because that was a marketplace that was big. And ever since that time, the world has been our oyster. We have owned the processes. We have been disproportionately represented in Congress from the time we reached the age of 30 until today. We continue to be way disproportionately represented in Congress. The average age in Congress is in the late 50s now, because of the fact that we have held on to power for so long, because we are a cohort, and our cohort tends to vote in a very similar, homogeneous manner. We are the cohort that made Donald Trump.
So the great generation, which was the one before ours.
They call them the quiet generation,
yeah,
too.
Yes. So they are all but gone.
Yes.
And so just thinking about the sheer numbers in Milwaukee alone, and when I was in high school, almost all the high schools had over 2,000 students in them.
They were building.
Just to give you an idea of the impact of what you say.
Well, when you were in high school, I would guess that the Milwaukee Public School System had students well over 100,000.
120,000.
Right. Now they're
today about 58,000.
Right. And some of that is movement to parochial schools, but mainly it's a reduction in the number of students. The baby boom was this, what they describe as a python passing through a pig passing through the python. We're still passing through. We still have control. And the next generation that's anywhere near as big as us, but nowhere near as big, as the millennial generation.
Which is just starting out. For the most part.
Well, they're reaching significant adulthood at this point.
Yeah,
yes.
But I mean, from the perspective of building their futures and all those kind of things, and their families. And
incidentally, Obama was a boomer. He was born in 61, and he was the last of the boomers. Well, not really, because Trump, and now Biden. Biden isn't even a boomer. He precedes the boomers by 3 years or 4 years.
You know, and so when we're in that, and this is what I keep saying to people, is we're still going to command and demand the resources. We're still here.
We're still wreaking havoc when you get down to it. We're leaving behind quite a mess. We're participating in the mess that relates to the upside downness of Social Security because of the size. This pig is now retiring, and this pig is requiring a lot of Social Security payments from the younger generations that are much smaller. We have continued to hold control of legislatures and Congress. We have control of power. We have control of wealth. We continue to control a significant portion of the wealth that is held in America.
And you know what we don't have? We don't have any guilt about what it is we've done and what we're doing.
Yes, and our demographics are particularly white, and we're particularly Christian. And the demographics of each of the generations after us. When we were young, and our generation is I can't give you the percentage, but if you were not white, you were black, and the black percentage was well under 10% of our generation. Each generation after us is less white and more non-white, but also less black in terms of the percentage. And we whites, when we get polled, have this theory that everyone who's not white is going to essentially collude against us. If, you know, in other words, statistics are talked about. Whites are no longer going to be the majority in 2040, okay? That ignores the fact that whites will continue to be by far the biggest voting, the biggest cohort of this country, will, if you do it by race, will be white from 2040 on into the future. But we won't be the majority. Well, why would the majority matter unless you're going to assume that people who aren't white are going to vote consistently against the interest of whites?
So Sandy, at the root of a lot of the issues we are dealing with today is that dynamic you just pointed out.
Yes.
And people aren't willing to have that conversation. And so if you, and I often say, I wonder if white people in this country really realize that globally, whites only make up 10% of the global population.
Well, incidentally, what is clear is that this white generation, our generation, the last of the really white generations, is trying to hold on to what
yes.
we recall, which is essentially what we would call this white Christian America. That's the America that to be made great again. But it isn't America. It doesn't reflect the American population. Well, incidentally, the West, what we describe as the West, is the white population of the world, okay?
Right.
And the white population of the world is used to being in control of the world. And I believe that the dynamic we have ongoing in the world right now with the West being against essentially, or maybe the world lining up with the West and everyone else, is a much like what's happened in the United States with the baby boomers lining up in a view that everyone else is against them. And that isn't the case or needn't be the case in the United States, and it isn't the case or needn't be the case in the world, but I have a sense that what's going on in America is a bit a microcosm of what's going on in the world.
It's not only, Sandy, an accurate depiction of what's taking place, but it's what's taking place is inevitable. Whites have zero population growth. So every time there's a white born that dies, there is not another to take the place of the white, and for whatever reason, and they're not having children as much as they did during the baby boom.
Well, prosperity defeats fertility is what happens, really. It happens across the world. Every country that gets a prosperous economy ends up with a fertility rate which either is at or below replacement rate. And almost every highly developed country in the world right now has a fertility rate that is less than the replacement rate, meaning that the population is shrinking. Our growth in America, we are 335 million
right.
now, is basically been attributed for a number of decades now to immigration.
So the demographers are aware of this, and they have been for a long time. I think it's just that maybe now some Americans are starting to hear about this, but not through the proper channels and not with the right explanations. And it makes them frightful.
Well, it makes them frightful. And so, for instance, there's this concept out there of the Great Replacement Theory.
Yes.
There's a theory ongoing amongst particularly the baby boom generation that all this immigration is a nefarious plot.
To replace
white people with non-white immigrants. When that might be the outcome of it.
Which is inevitable.
Which is inevitable based on birth rates in the world and migration patterns and whatever. But it's not a conspiracy driven by some political motive. It's really just an inevitable, it's the freight train that's happening.
And you know, Sandy, and then you mix that with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and others who get snippets of that information and they see it through a different light.
Well, no, they see it. They are essentially.
Oh, they're the ones who really do.
They're the militia for this outlook, okay?
Right.
I mean, really, people should. This book was profound to me, is profound to me. I haven't finished it because I really think this guy does not have an axe to grind. He is just uncovering data that when you look at all the data, you begin to say, oh, I see why things are the way they are.
And it is something that I think everybody should read and be able to understand, because then it explains the hostilities. And until we're ready to get beyond that, Sandy, I don't see how we're ever going to overcome this. Maybe it is through books like the one you are talking about, and maybe how do you get people to want to read something of that nature that is pointing out what is inevitable? For somebody who doesn't want to believe that is inevitable. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. I mean, I just think...
So, we have to go to break. It's an interesting subject. 844-967-2789. Would love to hear your opinions on it. Either or, you know, yin or yang. But it is clearly what is taking place. And it explains a lot of different things. We'll be right back. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. Show, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy. And Sandy, I don't think we've had a better conversation than the one we're talking about now. We've had a lot of great conversations, but this one is one that all Americans need to face and need to hear and need to participate in, because all of these things we're talking about, we can't seem to figure out why we're faced with all these different issues in this country. But that book you're talking, what's the name of the book again?
The Aftermath, Philip Bump is the guy's name.
The Aftermath.
Yeah.
And that's an apropos title.
It's talking about the aftermath of the baby boom. You know, we're moving into the period of the aftermath. We aren't there. But, you know, the demographics and the sort of the cultural, psychological, cultural aspect of the baby boom cohort, what we experienced, how we view ourselves, who we are, has so much to do with the current state of things, polarity. Most of the polarity is intergenerational as much as it is. So the baby boomers comprise a great deal of what is the conservative polarity, and the non-baby boomers comprise the rest. I mean, it isn't rigid that way. There's obviously exceptions that prove the rule, but the baby boomers have a view of the world that is different than the view that is held by the rest. And the baby boomers, who have had such control over things, can feel the America that they knew and controlled slipping away from them. And so they are actually experiencing, as a group, intergenerational tension and intergenerational fear, even from the generations that embody their children and grandchildren, because those generations are quite different.
So I always contrast that, Sandy, to the great generation, the greatest generation, and my parents in their generation, which I was able to, and live and was old enough to see that generation and the impact that that generation had on our generations as young people, right? I was born at the right time to be able to manifest what I saw through my parents' generation, what they did, the sacrifices they made for us, and then now see, contrast that with us, the baby boomers, and we're nowhere near the people that our parents were. I'm just sorry.
No, I mean, with our parents.
Am I wrong?
No, you're right. Our parents gave us all that they could. We also gave them back in kind because we created an economy for the 20 years after 1950. The prosperity of our economy was in large part attributed to this massive growth of our generation and the massive growth of our economy, which our parents who were employed were able to ride the crest of, and which we were able to ride the crest of as we became employees. So that our generation, which ends in 1964, almost all of us came into an economy that was very receptive
no question.
To us. And the people at the tail end of that, people who were born in 64, ended up going to work during a recession in the beginning of the Reagan years. But everyone before that stepped into prosperity. And we have known an America that is far different than the generations that followed us.
There's no question, Sandy, that looking at it through that prism, and I can look at it through my own eyes, right, that I've experienced, and I know the baby boom generation, and our parents who did all they could and sacrificed to send the kids to school. Save money.
Yeah, college was something that the family bore the brunt of. There weren't student loans to
didn't
pass
want
it
the
on.
Kids didn't want the kids to graduate with debt. Didn't buy didn't get the automobile, new cars every year.
No boats, no snowmobiles.
Yeah, no summer cottage. You know, it was all, and that was just. And maybe, Sandy, that was because their parents came out of the Depression.
Yeah, well, our parents grew up in the Depression, right?
Right.
So they experienced it. They treasured the prosperity they had. They wanted to pass on in a conservative way. They saved money. But, I mean, our generation, really, until the very tail end of it, none of us ever worried about a job we were going to get. If we got out of high school, we were going to take a job that was a union blue-collar job that was going to pay us quite well. If we went to college, we knew we were going to get a job at the end of college. There was no problem. That's just a different story than almost every generation after us can tell. And today's kids getting done with school, now we've got everyone worrying about whether the school they go to is going to train them for a job.
You know, Sandy, it does make you pause and look at where all this is headed in the end, because something's going to come to pass whether people want them to happen or not. They're just going to come to pass. That's the reality of the life cycle and all those things. And what I don't understand, I do in a way, but the young people are going to inherit what this is, because just based on the life cycles, we can't prevent that, right?
Yeah.
So the
end of the baby boomers now are 59 years old, so we still have people working. Those baby boomers that are 59 are the CEOs of the companies.
Right.
We have plenty of baby boomers who control the wealth. The stock market is, I'm sure, predominantly owned by baby boomers.
But as you stated, those are the end of the baby boomers, right?
Well, the ones who are 59
right.
are, but people who are younger than 75 are so it's 59 to 75.
All right, got to go to the break. 844-967-2789. So you're part of the great generation.
Never mind.
We gotta go to
quiet, Earl.
A break. Let me see. I have to pull my shoes off. 844-967. We'll be right back. I didn't mean anything. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Wynn. And Sandy, it's a fascinating, fascinating, fascinating discussion you and I are having. And we love to hear others chime in on it. But if they don't, that's fine. We'll continue this discussion because I think at the root of it, Sandy, is part of what needs to be discussed and debated and out in the open, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it should be out in the open. And that's how you begin to have people have the dialogues and maybe say, oh, yeah, right. Now I understand that.
Well, you know, what opened my eyes, I was reading it, then realized the extent to which the baby boom generation experiences fear because of the change underlying them as the succeeding generations are different than they are, have a different experience than they do, have not experienced the same prosperity that they have.
Right.
And begin to feel threatened about the changes that will result from the changed circumstance. And then I looked at the world and realized that the West, you know, the world has become beginning to be polarized between the West and everyone else. And it's kind of the same story there. The West is ethnically homogeneous, essentially the only non-white country that isn't in. First of all, every country in the West, as far as I can tell, is essentially white. Turkey is
right.
The closest to non-white, I suspect. And maybe Japan is considered part of the West. But Russia's about the only all-white country.
Yeah, Japan's yellow man.
Yeah, that's not part of the West. But the West is beginning to treat the rest of the world in a way that's causing the rest of the world to potentially act in collusively with one another, in collusion with one another against the West. But it isn't because they're against the West, it's the West is pushing them into a corner, right? So that China and Russia and India and these countries tend to be beginning to look like what is like collusive behavior against the West. But which is it, chicken or egg? And the same is true in the United States with polarity in terms of the baby boom generation being essentially a polar, one side of a polar split with the rest of the generations. And that's a rule that's clearly got plenty of exceptions to it, but it's a fairly good generalization. When you do a demographic analysis of the conservatives in America, they are dominantly baby boomers and they have a dominant characteristic racially. And when you do an analysis of the non-conservatives in the country, they are different.
You know, Sandy, the generations that come after the baby boomers know that they aren't, for the most part, going to be able to live their lives as well as the baby boomers. They'll never be as successful as the baby boomers, right?
Well, in fact, I think the polling recently has parents today for the first time believing that their children won't live
as well as they did.
And that's I don't even why they had to take a poll because it's quite apparent.
Right.
But you can just do an analysis of incomes of the middle class, and the middle class today does not live as well as the middle class of America did in 1970. You know, we have more creature comforts available that are more affordable, so every family has a huge TV. That wasn't the case in 1970. But when you look at the amount of income that a single breadwinner earned and the number of families that were middle class that had only a single breadwinner in the 70s, much different than today. And the median income and the gap between median individual and median family income is greater today. And the lifestyle of the median income family today is made more difficult by the lack of benefits, health in particular, that was commonplace.
You know, Sandy, and then you just go down the list, and you keep going down the list, and it's going to be more and more difficult for each additional generation. There's something going on that has to be corrected. How do you fix it, Sandy? Because there's got to be, at some given point in time, we need to look at what those generations coming behind us and fix what we're looking at right now. So the ones coming behind us and coming behind the generation X's and millennials, because this has to be corrected at some way, shape, or form. Let's go to Bill from O'Connor. Good morning, Bill. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Good morning. As usual, you got a great discussion. I don't know how you pick them, but you pick some wonderful topics. On the next generation not having it as good as the previous generation, first of all, we're in a culture that always evolves. We went from the industrial revolution, whatever you want to call it, and creating a middle class, which we did, to now in a more of an electronic age, or, you know,
technological, yeah.
Right, technological. But here's something I don't know if I completely agree with you. I believe that if kids are shown the right opportunities, and I'm speaking from my family, and they all aren't going to college, by the way. They all aren't going to college. It's out there if they want it. It's out there if they want it. And even let's talk about the people, the kids that don't get the shot, a lot of other kids. Let's talk about the underprivileged across the boards. If the right people, it doesn't even have to be mom and dad, because maybe they don't even exist. Maybe it's grandma. Maybe it's an aunt. Somebody inspires them in the right way. They can be anything they want to be in this day and age.
Well,
and to say that they don't have a shot at it, I think, is a defeatist attitude. Am I right? Am I wrong?
Well, hang on, Bill. Let's hang on. Hang on.
Well,
go ahead, Sandy.
I do think you're wrong in that. I think there are a bunch of people who aren't. I would say that someone who has an aunt or a grandmother or a father who's spurring them on and inspiring them is at least on second base. They've been born on second base with the opportunity that's provided them by someone in the family who inspires them and provides a role model. And in whether they have money or not, that sort of inspiration can move you forward. But there are too many people in our economy right now who aren't born in that fashion. They aren't born on second base. They're still at home plate trying to get to first base. And so I think we have problems in our society that can't be pulled up by their own bootstraps. I think when we talk like you are about people basically have bootstraps and all they need to do is bend over and pull up on their bootstraps and they can get themselves going, disregards the fact that there are just a bunch of people who aren't in that situation. And I think it's because you're a boomer like I am. We didn't see that. We didn't live in that environment. We definitely lived in a bootstrap environment where it was there for the taking if you just had the gumption to take it. And I just think in today's world, first of all, it's not there for the taking. I can tell you that people with college educations and otherwise, plenty of them are waiting tables and they aren't driving
buses
or doing Uber,
right?
Or doing, you know, they're doing a job, but it's not a career. It's not a pathway that's going to get them from here to there. And so, you know, I wish that you were right. But I guess I think you aren't right.
So Bill, is Bill waxing nostalgic? Because
no, I just think we all have our own. We all live within the world in which we live, and we project from what we know and
what worked for us,
and what we know, and so we don't really know what it's like to be in that world,
other person,
that
right?
Other world that does exist. Yeah, you know?
Bill,
Earl,
yes, sir.
If I could counter, absolutely. You and Sandy are already making a difference. You help educating people. My point is, you're already making a difference. And to Sandy's point about bootstraps, yeah, I'll meet him in the middle and even say, you're right. But if society And I see it a lot. And maybe I live in a bubble. I apologize if I do. I see plenty of opportunities for underprivileged kids to get the go to second base. Like, and that's a perfect.
So Bill, let me say this.
What do you think?
This is not just underprivileged children. There are privileged people whose children are finding it hard, who graduate from college and can't find a job commensurate with what is going to give them a leg up in their future. As a matter of fact, they've got to struggle to pay that college debt that they may that will plague them. I know people in their 50s still paying off college debt. So, I mean, you know, that wasn't the case 30 years ago, Sandy. Not to the point where it paralyzed people's upward mobility.
Well, no, I mean, like I said, the way we've set the economy up now has put young people in a box that's different than the ones we had. I think those people are going to be okay. Yeah, I just think there are plenty of people in our economy who are, first of all, we have far too many people in the economy, just statistically, living paycheck to paycheck, which in today's world without benefits is a desperate state. So psychologically, if you live paycheck to paycheck, even if you're making it, you know, in terms of, you still are living a life of desperation.
Stress, yeah.
And stress. And there's far more stress in our system today than there ever was in the past. And that stress is bleeding out into our social activities and our social interactions. And I think we ought to just face up to it. I just worry about America's capacity to face up to our realities.
Bill?
Hear me, can't you?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Earl, you yourself, I know for a fact, is making a difference.
Yeah, but...
I know for a fact, you're... Now, wait a minute. Just hang on, Earl. You're not the only person like that out there. There's a lot of people. Now, when we were younger, I don't remember anything even close to what I'm going to call is the humanitarian factor. And if I'm wearing rose glasses, rip them off my face right now. But the thing is, you're making a difference here. You're helping people that otherwise, you're their only bootstrap. I know you are. And the thing is, it's just not Earl or Bill or Sandy. There's plenty of more, and those opportunities I see growing. You know Larry Heisel as good as I do. Look at what he has done.
Yeah, but
and I can go on and on and on. Now, if I'm wrong, I'm coming to you.
Well, for, no, I don't think
either a blessing or a you know whatever.
No, I don't think I don't think you're wrong about the impact that people can have. I just think we need many, many more people. I think it takes a village. It takes a city. It takes all the suburbs. You know, the fact is that we've got a moat that surrounds most of our problems, and it's the municipal boundary, and we've got most of the people of means living outside that boundary. We need more of those people to exercise the kind of spirit that you're describing. And, you know, that is ultimately the way we're going to solve this. We're not solving it very quickly right now, though.
You know, and Bill, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, I was talking with a guy who's the president of the Greater Milwaukee. What is
Greater Milwaukee Committee?
Committee, it might have been. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and we're going to be having him on the air, and he was talking about, you know, what needs to happen as we were talking about the growth of Milwaukee and all those things downtown. And he said, yeah, but there's another Milwaukee. And I can't just talk about the great things that are happening there. He said to me,
yeah,
we need help with the other Milwaukee. We need help from the state. We need help from the federal government. So he got it. You know what I mean? He's in a position where he can say, well, look at what's happening here. But he's visionary enough to say, yeah, but, you know, there's this other side of things that we've got to focus on.
Well, and in fact, I think the problem we've got in America, he's right. There are two Americas. And the problem is that other America is probably growing more rapidly based on the inability to access the middle class and to access comfort within the middle class, because the group we defined as middle class now lives paycheck to paycheck. We found that out.
Yeah.
And we found that out during the pandemic, and we find it out with data.
And it just doesn't include people of color.
No, right.
I know.
Absolutely not.
So we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So actually... All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Let's go to Mike from Cedarburg. Good morning to you, Mike. Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
I say, remember that old cartoon strip where Pogo said, I have seen the enemy, and it is us.
Yeah. And there's no question that you're a baby boomer. Know who Pogo was.
I'll tell you what, we're a specialty contractor. We work all over the Midwest, a union contractor. And I remember when Scott Walker was running for governor, and all these tradesmen, well, he's going to give us concealed carry. I said, that's fine, but he won't be able to afford buy bullets. Consequently, very few jobs in this state are prevailing wage anymore. State jobs are, but most county jobs are not.
Right.
And so we have to bid against people sending people up from Alabama and Mississippi for $15 an hour. Good luck with that, huh? And like I said, they're shooting themselves in the foot. You can't tell these people that.
Mike. What you just said is the people, and I talked about this yesterday when we talked about the prevailing. Not the prevailing wage, but the, where right to work and the impact that that has. The fact that you are competing against people who are bringing people up, paying them $15 an hour, if that wasn't there, then that prevailing wage would have to happen, and then people who are here would be able to work those jobs and make this the living that the people you are offering.
Well, since the 1980s and all of this consciousness about labor wages, it's been a race to the bottom for the middle class. And that's really been, we can blame it on globalization, but it's really been that the United States has allowed itself to build business models that are based on wages that are too low, not living wages. And so, for instance, all the businesses that rely on something like hourly workers that are close to minimum wage, it's not a living wage. And even the $15 an hour wage that they talk about raising the minimum wage to is not a living wage. So I think what Mike is talking about, this prevailing wage concept, really, we should, as a matter of decency, have a notion in our economy that if someone is employed full time, that they would earn enough money to be a participant in the economy in a safe way. Is that what you're saying, Mike?
Well, that's true, but don't ever say right to work. It's called right to work for less.
But I don't think the people understood that, Mike.
No, they don't. I say they vote against their best interests. They grab onto a single issue. Look at the big picture, folks. What is it going to do for you except drive you further into poverty? I could get a loan to get this. Yeah, but the loan, they want the money back, folks. I remember when I was a kid, you bought it, you paid cash. There was no credit cards. I come from a family of six kids. My dad wasn't rich, but he raised us all as a single earner. Nowadays.
You know, Mike, I say the same thing. There were 13 of us, and my dad worked all those years as a single earner, and he was able to provide, and we were never hungry, and we always had food on the table, clothes on our back.
Yeah, like I said, it's not anecdotal. Our baby boom generation lived in households where a single earner could get middle-class income, and we didn't need child daycare because we had a second. Most households had a second person who was able to take care of the
mom.
Kids.
Yeah, mom, generally.
And so, our experience is different, and we have trouble projecting the reality of today into our thought process, which is one of the reasons for polarity.
Well, which is why, Sandy, we hear people even who call here and say, as a country, we can't afford to pay people's daycare. If those people, they shouldn't have had children. That's our response, right? Unfortunately. Not that the children are here, but they shouldn't have had children if they couldn't afford them. That's a part of what all of this is that we're talking about.
Well, I guess, except the people who say that have a different view of prenatal rights and postnatal rights and caring for children or caring for the fetus. I mean, we've got a bunch of dichotomies in our political spectrum that don't line up very well. But mainly what we have is an inability of, I think, of the baby boom generation to empathize with the situation that exists outside of our group.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. You know, Sandy, I what's the name of the book again?
Aftermath.
And who is it by?
Philip Bump, who's apparently a Washington Post reporter, but I'm telling you, it's not a liberal or conservative thing. It's really kind of a learned piece that is basically demographic data.
Well, it shouldn't be. In that instance, Democrat conservatives is not the issue.
But a Washington Post, listening who might be a conservative would say if it's written by a Washington Post guy, it must be biased. I found it to be very straightforward and to just provide a bunch of data which you can reach your own conclusions about.
Well, but you can see those things, some of us, with our own eyes, right?
Yep.
You know, and so until we come to that realization, Sandy, and are able to have these kind of conversations, I think we're going to be stuck in the mud.
Yeah, self-examination can be eye-opening, and if it isn't eye-opening, you're not getting anything out of it. So I do think one of the problems we have as a society generally is we just don't do enough self-examination, you know, and it doesn't have to be done with long hair and Michael Morris type thing. It just needs to be reflection on what is the reality of what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yeah. You know, Sandy, as always, great conversation, man. Really, really appreciate it. What you going to do this weekend?
This weekend? Well, you know, I might be forced to. Well, it's going to snow.
Maybe you'll do some skiing, huh?
Yeah.
Or tobogganing.
No, none of the above.
Okay. Right. We will see you later. Thank you, everybody, who made the show go. I'll be back on Monday. Sandy and I, have a great weekend. Let you down.